Welcome to From Beneath the Hollywood Sign. If you love old movies, Hollywood history, or the golden age of filmmaking, you've come to the right place. This is the podcast that talks about amazing stories of Tinseltown from another era and fascinating conversations with writer-producer Steve Kubine and actress-writer Nan McNamara.
So, Steve, did Ava Gardner and Howard Hughes have a good relationship?
Well, they did, until he dislocated her jaw.
What?
Well, don't worry. She hit him back with an ashtray.
From Beneath the Hollywood Sign is the gin joint for you.
The world is filled with many questions, such as, did giants exist?
What is junk DNA? Does it mean that you're trash?
Do you ever wonder if aliens have underwater bases in our oceans, and that's why there are so many UFO sightings off the coasts of islands all over the world?
How serious even is climate change, and when should we start building our rafts?
Hello, everyone. You may recognize me as Gabby from the History of Everything podcast.
And my name is Brenna, and you don't recognize me from anything yet.
Together, we're two scientists who explore the answers to these questions and many, many more in our new podcast, Mystery of Everything, available everywhere you get your podcasts.
Welcome to the Most Notorious Podcast. I'm Eric Rivenis. I'm grateful to have as my guest today Juliet Mofford. She's a professional historian and museum educator and has been researching, writing, and teaching about 17th century New England and the Salem witch trials for 30 years. She's written many books, but the one we're talking about today is The Devil Made Me Do It: Crime and Punishment in Early New England. Thank you so much for your time.
Yeah, you're welcome. Nice to be here.
So why New England and why the 17th century?
I got a degree in art history, but then we moved to Andover, Massachusetts, and I became intrigued by the Salem witch trials because I learned that there were more people accused, arrested, and confessed to witchcraft from Andover, Massachusetts, than from any other town. And soon after that, I became a museum educator and director of research at the Old York Historical Society in York, Maine, now known as the Museums of Old York. One of their 8 historic sites is a jail from 1719, using timbers and architectural elements from a 1653 prison, which made it the oldest public building still in use, not as a jail, but now as a museum in the country. And while I was at that job, I had access to court records, primary sources such as the jailer's accounts, sermons, and other documents related to the history of crime and punishment in early New England. And also, the more that I studied this period, 17th century, I realized how Puritans were so misunderstood, thanks to fiction writers like Hawthorne and Longfellow. And the more I studied the court records, the more I saw that Puritans were a bunch of lusty folk. It was the Victorians who were so uptight. So the fascination with that period for me has continued.
That's great. So your book starts with the Puritans. So I'd like to start there too. Talk about the Puritans in early New England and how they viewed crime and punishment.
Right. Well, the Puritans and the Pilgrims, the difference being that the Pilgrims, who came a little earlier, 20 years, whatever, earlier, they wanted to break totally from the Church of England. The Puritans got their name because they wanted to purify the Anglican Church and go back to the early Bible, live by the Bible. So they came, when they came over, both Puritans and Pilgrims, they followed biblical law, scripture, and they also brought a knowledge of English law with them to the New World. For example, they had juries. However, there were no defense lawyers, as we know that today. The Puritans and Pilgrims both believed that punishment should be swift and designed to keep the community in control. Punishments were meant to deter crime. The most common was humiliation, public ridicule, such as the stocks and the pillories and getting whipped at the whipping post. And children were encouraged to throw rocks and rotten eggs at people in the pillory because those were teaching moments. So there were strict laws even in terms of the Sabbath day, Sundays. They couldn't even cook or go fishing on the Lord's Day, couldn't even kiss your wife or husband. No cooking because they believed, quote, the smell of food was an abomination to the nostrils of the Lord. So they stuck to that until those punishments, until actually the mid-1700s.
Can you explain what a pillory is?
It's a wooden board, and you stand with your head in a hole and your hands in a hole, and usually there's a sign saying what your crime was, like drunkenness. They even put quarreling couples into stocks. Stocks is when you sit down and your hands and feet, not your head, but your hands and feet are in the holes that have been put in these boards. And the boards you can lift up and down, obviously. But the most common was whipping and charging fines and having to go in front of the congregation in the meeting house and confess your crime.
What were some of the crimes most common during the time of the Puritans?
Well, the most common, according to the early court records, was what they called disguised with drink, which was drunkenness. And the second most common was fornication. That's what I meant when I said the Puritans were a lusty bunch. Scholars have shown from the records, from the documents, that around 1700, in the early 1700s, before the Revolution, one-third of the women were pregnant when they got married. And, you know, they would measure or they would count the months. And if you had a baby, you know, before, say, 8 months, then you had to go in front of the meeting house and you would be fined, or you and your husband-to-be or lover would be in the stocks or the pillory. Most people don't realize, but those are fascinating records to read, you can imagine.
What was a common length of time for someone to be committed to a stock or a pillory?
Oh, well, that depended, of course, on your crime and how many times you had, whatever, been drunk or broken that law. Also, such things as witchcraft and arson were capital crimes. And another common crime was what they called thieving, stealing. And you are supposed to pay back three times the worth of whatever you stole, which is why a lot of people ended up in prison, because they couldn't come up with that. That was also the most common crime among servants, was stealing, and usually in their case, it was food.
Can you tell us about the first execution in New England?
Right. First execution, which the Pilgrims called, quote, a matter of great sadness, was on September 30th, 1630, when John Billington was hanged for the murder of a fellow named John Newcomb, N-E-W-C-O-M-E-N, killed with a blunderbuss. But Billington had been in trouble. He was a known knave. He had caused trouble even on the Mayflower and had been punished before in the stocks for several things, for stealing. So that was the first murder. And, of course, a capital crime because it still is, thou shalt not kill. But executions from that time and into even past the Revolution were public events. Everyone went to, shops were closed up, and everyone brought their families and the children to the executions. Food was sold, and ministers would accompany the criminal to the scaffold, to the gallows, and everyone was eager to hear the prisoner's dying words, because that was supposed to be a lesson to the community. And ministers often preached at the gallows or before the executions in the meeting houses, and then they would publish their sermons afterwards. So these were all lessons for the living.
How did you say he was executed? By hanging, right?
They were hanged. There were no burnings. The only known burning, because a lot of people still think that witches were burned in New England. They were not. That was true in Europe, but not in... It was only hanging in this country, always execution by hanging. But the only case of burning were two servants, two blacks in Cambridge, which was then known as Newtown, and that was for murdering their master.
Were they tied to a stake and burned that way?
Yeah, but that's the only case I ever came across in 17th century or early 18th century, pre-revolutionary New England. So, but witches were never burned here.
What was the relationship between Puritans and Native Americans? And when Native Americans were accused of crimes, how did Puritans treat them in comparison to other Puritans?
Well, as most school children know, when the Pilgrims first came, they got along pretty well because there had been a smallpox epidemic that had wiped out thousands and thousands of Native Americans. They think it's smallpox, but it might have been measles. No one knows for sure. But after 1675, which was King Philip's War, there was nearly constant warfare and massacres in New England, Massachusetts and Rhode Island and Maine, because Maine was a part of Massachusetts then. And when Native Americans were caught and accused of crimes, they were probably treated more harshly than white offenders. But what they usually did, if it was a serious crime, was to ship them out of the colony, banish them. They would be sent into slavery into the West Indies to work on the sugar plantation. Puritans and Pilgrims saw Native Americans as agents of the devil, and they were shocked by, their near nakedness and how they painted their bodies, and they were pagans, they weren't Christian. So I think there was fear of them. And the most serious crime, most commonly committed by Native Americans, was arson. They used arson as a weapon of war all through the French and Indian Wars. The Native Americans would burn barns full of animals. And my theory is that I think if they saw how the English depended on their cattle and sheep, and I think they thought if they got rid of the animals, maybe they'd all go back to England. When the French came over, they came not as families, but more as trappers in northern New England. But the English came and established villages. and they intended to stay, and they brought their women and their whole families. So English, the colonists didn't like those pagan Indians very much, and they feared them greatly.
What were the names of the tribes most in contact with the Puritans?
Oh, wow. They were all part, in this area, there were many smaller tribes, but they were all of the Abenaki, A-B-E-N-A-K-I in English. But that included the Wabanaki, the Wampanoags, which were more around the Cape area, the southern New England. There were many different smaller groups, but they were all Abenaki, unified by their language, I think.
What was the ordeal by touch?
Right. That was a very strange means of convicting a murderer. And it was based on the Bible in God's judgment versus Cain in the book of Genesis. The idea was that when a suspected murderer would touch the dead victim, the corpse would bleed, and that would prove the guilt. And I can't imagine it worked, but there some said it did, even in court, in the trials. But King James I is the one that really promoted that. That was like 1590s, that if a secret murder of the dead body be handled by the murderer, it will gush out blood, crying to heaven for revenge. That's from King James I. And it was actually used as per means of conviction until 1769. The last known case was in West Boxford, Mass. So it was a strange thing, but they believed it.
So you have a chapter about governing the family. Could you talk about how harmony was kept in the home in the early days of America?
Right. And that was so important to them. Because if there was not harmony within the family, then God could punish the whole community by sending an epidemic or an Indian invasion or some terrible natural thing like a typhoon or a hurricane. So everyone had their place in early New England, and that meant that women were expected to stay in their place. If you couldn't control your teenagers, they could be taken from you and put in another home. You had to dress according to your station or else you would be fined. There were curfews so no one could do what they called night walking. And on Sundays, the minister would go to the taverns and clear out the taverns to get so everyone would get ready for the Sabbath day at the meeting house. Everyone was also encouraged to bear witness or to spy on their neighbors and tattle. And if there was a family that was what we would call dysfunctional, they would be punished or fined. Even quarreling couples were put in the stocks and humiliated in front of the community. Or you couldn't swear. There's a case in, I think it was Kittery, Maine. Lydia Abbott was locked in the stocks for uttering 10 profane curses. And no one could live alone. If you were a spinster woman, you were expected to live with your family. If you were a man traveling through living alone, you could be fined or warned out of town, which meant that the selectmen just escorted you to the town boundaries. So there was a lot of control. And even in meeting houses, you sat according to your rank. In the meeting house, there was a tithing man who went around to make sure no one was falling asleep. The worst were women known as railing women or scolds. They definitely got punished. They didn't like feisty females were frowned upon.
Hello all, Eric here. So if you are not a big fan of advertisements disrupting the flow of an interview, there is an option. Go to patreon.com/mostnotorious, and for just $2 a month, get all my episodes ad-free. This will not only be for the Most Notorious podcast, but also for my new podcast debuting in September of 2018 called Where Blood Runs Cold, a collection of terrifying historical true crime stories from my home state, Minnesota. And for $4 a month, you'll not only get the ad-free episodes, but bonus content as well, including extra episodes, special commentary, and more. So skip the ads, support the show, and listen to new stuff by going to patreon.com/mostnotorious. That's Patreon, patreon.com/mostnotorious. See you there. Cheers. Now back to the interview. Were there specific punishments for specific crimes, or were the punishments arbitrary?
Well, there were examples, and it depended on the communities. Sometimes railing women or scolds got dunked. Witches were not dunked, but as many people believe. But if you were a woman who couldn't control her her temper, you could be put in a chair and dunked into the river, tied into a chair and then dunked into a river. And that was supposed to, I guess, cool you off. And that was all part of public humiliation, because the whole community, and certainly the children too, would be there yelling at you and calling you names. You know, the crimes varied. I mean, the punishment for crimes varied from community to community, except for the capital crimes, witchcraft, for example, murder, obviously, arson. They were all capital crimes that you could be hanged for. And also a severe punishment was not respecting ministers and magistrates. And there's a case of Philip Radcliffe from Medford, Mass., who got the only case I found of getting his ears cropped. He got whipped and both ears cropped, which meant part of his ears were cut off. That was early, 1631. And his crime was uttering foul and scandalous invectives against church and government. But he was lucky, because they only threw him out of the colony. Blasphemy, which was his crime, actually could carry the death sentence.
A lot of people utter invectives against the government these days, don't they?
Well, that's true. That's true. Maybe we should bring back. No, we better not get into that.
You write that as small children, Puritans and pilgrims were taught that idle hands were the devil's tools. How did these communities govern themselves with this idiom in mind?
Right. Well, I think that comes from the Bible. I'm not exactly sure word for word, but you could get into trouble if you didn't keep your hands busy. You know, if you were a girl with sewing and spinning, and if you were a boy helping your dad with the carpentry or the farm chores. And I think part of it is just that work was a survival in early New England. Everybody had to work. And apprenticeships went on well into the 19th century, you know, where a boy would be put in another home with a carpenter or a blacksmith, and he would be taught a trade. And the same with girls. If a family could spare a daughter who wasn't needed to take care of the younger children or help with the cooking in a big family, she might be put out, they called it, into another family where she would learn housekeeping skills. So it was the delinquent, what they called delinquent and incorrigible youth. If you couldn't control your teenager who kept night walking, you might find that child placed in another family. So I think it's idle hands. That actually was in their earliest primer, New England primer, that elementary school kids studied, that idle hands were the devil's tools. if you weren't busy helping your family and community with work, then, you know, you were, the devil could come and recruit you to help him.
Right. So let's move to what you call the first colonial crime wave, crimes against religion.
Right.
How did these crimes manifest themselves, and how were they dealt with by community authorities?
Right. Well, religion, as we know, was very, very important to the Puritans and the Pilgrims. And I call it the first crime wave. They called it the Quaker invasion. And we talk about, you know, religious freedom. And yes, they came over for their religious freedom, but they didn't accept other religions or groups until after the Charter of 1693, what they called the New Charter. I think John Winthrop, Governor Winthrop, said, yes, they can practice other religion, but not in our colony. So, of course, as most people know, they would be sent to Rhode Island, or they would move to Rhode Island, which the Puritans often called Rogues Island, R-O-G-U-E, Rogues Island. But the Quakers were a real threat to the Puritans. They came over from England by way of Barbados with the goal of breaking Puritan power. And they were very political in that sense. So they were known as vagrants because they went all around the Massachusetts colonies and towns trying to spread their religion. And worse, they refused to respect or pledge allegiance to either the king. They refused to doff their hats before the magistrates and the ministers, as was the custom. And they would refuse to serve in the militia, which was required of every young-blooded New England boy in those days. And the Quakers would be shown out of towns, but they kept coming back. And eventually a few were hanged in Massachusetts. But after being on trial and fined and warned three or four times, you could also be fined for entertaining Quakers. The punishment for Quakers was severe. You were stripped to the waist, male or female, and tied to the back of a cart, and you would be whipped from town to town. And people would line the roads jeering the Quakers. So they were treated pretty roughly. But they were a political threat as well as a religious threat. So it was, for the Puritans, it was our way or no way. And as I said, religion, they were strict even in the meeting house. You could be fined if you didn't go to meeting, unless you were, the only excuse was illness or death in the family, I guess. And it's interesting because in the early Salem witch trial records, it keeps showing up that the person who was accused of witchcraft had not attended meeting in many months.
When Johann Rahl received the letter on Christmas Day 1776, he put it away to read later. Maybe he thought it was a season's greeting and wanted to save it for the fireside. But what it actually was a warning, delivered to the Hessian colonel, letting him know that General George Washington was crossing the Delaware and would soon attack his forces. The next day, when Rahl lost the Battle of Trenton and died from two colonial Boxing Day musket balls, the letter was found, unopened, in his vest pocket. As someone with 15,000 unread emails in his inbox, I feel like there's a lesson there. Oh well, this is The Constant, a history of getting things wrong. I'm Mark Chrysler. Every episode, we look at the bad ideas, mistakes, and accidents that misshaped our world. Find us at constantpodcast.com or wherever you get your podcasts.
Everybody shush! William Shatner has something to say.
Cat and Jethro, box of oddities.
What do you do when the woman you love dies?
Well, of course you dig her up and you live with her.
Aww.
The show examines weird things.
There are plenty of old photographs from this time period of children out in the streets playing in and among the dead horse carcasses.
Oh, I miss those days. Things used to be so much simpler.
Cat and Jethro.
Then there's the urine wheel, which sounds like a really bad game show.
They've done weird things. Cat and Jethro, Box of Oddities. That is really mysterious.
Join Cat and Jethro Gilligan Toth for the strange, the bizarre, the unexpected, as they lift the lid and cautiously peer inside the Box of Oddities.
The Webby Award-winning Box of Oddities podcast from Airwave Media.
Some of us love history. Others used to or never did because history was presented as nothing but the rote memorization of names, dates, and facts. Basically, the story got left out, and that made history kind of suck. My name is Greg Jackson. I'm a university professor with a PhD in history, and bringing history to life is my passion. That's why I created my podcast, History That Doesn't Suck. I want to teach you everything you need to know about U.S. history, but I do so through stories. Let me tell you about George Washington begging his men not to mutiny against Congress. Clara Barton saving Union soldiers amid enemy fire. Enslaved Frederick Douglass risking his life for liberty. And about so many other figures as their real experiences make industrialization, social movements, and even congressional debates and tax policy come to life. Subscribe to History That Doesn't Suck today. And join me, Professor Greg Jackson, every other week for a new episode. Where I'd like to tell you a story.
The storm broke in Chattanooga one night in 1906 when a young woman was the victim of a violent crime. From that moment, the city knew no peace for four furious years. At the center of the storm was the notorious inmate, Dave Edwards, who was awaiting trial on murder charges. After a high-profile case threatened to go cold, the desperate county sheriff did the unthinkable by freeing Dave Edwards from jail and deputizing him to track down the fugitive. Grievous Deeds, 4 Years of Fury in Chattanooga, Tennessee, written by Kimberly Tilly, narrated by Samuel Burst, is the most amazing true crime story you've never heard. Listen to Grievous Deeds, the audiobook, available on Audible, iTunes, and Amazon.
Many of us are familiar with the concept of a scarlet letter, and lots of us here in America are required to read Nathaniel Hawthorne's The Scarlet Letter in junior high or middle school.
Right.
Can you frame the idea of a scarlet letter in the larger context of sexual deviancy?
Right. Well, there were many scarlet letters. And the first one I found was an adult case of adultery, 1639 in Duxbury, which is near Plymouth. A woman named Mary Mendame, M-E-N-D-A-M-E, was accused of, quote, dalliance diverse times with Tinsin, T-I-N-S-I-N, an Indian, and committing acts of uncleanness with him. She got whipped at the cart's tail like a Quaker, and I think they were more severe on her because she did it with an Indian, a Native American. And she had to wear A.D. for adultery for as long as she lived within the colony. There were numerous cases of or numerous people wearing letters, not only A's for adultery, because adultery was a hanging crime, a capital crime, although there were only a couple of cases of people being hanged for adultery. Usually it was wearing the letter, or it was kind of mock hanging where they would tie somebody to the gallows with the letter on them for a day or 2 days, but not hang them. The case I think that Hawthorne used, because Hawthorne went to Bowdoin, so he was familiar with these early New England stories. There was a case in 1641 in what's now Maine, where a woman named Mary Batchelder was punished for being with a minister, Reverend George Rogers, who was an adulterer. He received 40 lashes with the whip, but she had to wear a B for bawd, B-A-W-D, for the rest of her life. He got in trouble a couple of times, and he was eventually thrown out of Massachusetts, or actually what was then Maine. Sexual deviance, common, known as wanton dalliances. And it's been estimated by scholars that one-third of the brides in 1700 were pregnant when married, and that they were fined and had to appear and were sometimes before the congregation at the meeting house and were sometimes whipped. Usually the women were punished more severely than the men, because the belief was that because Eve had tempted Adam in the Garden of Eden, women more easily fell into carnal behavior. So in other words, they thought it was a woman's fault. But it was understandable that fornication might have been the second most common crime after drunkenness, because people didn't marry before 1700 until it was about 20. The average age was 26 years for men and 20 to 21 years for women. And apprentices and servants, that would be indentured servants, could not marry until their terms had been completed. And some of them had not only 7 but 14-year terms to serve their masters. So no wonder they're all that night walking, right?
Right. Talk, if you would, about witches. What was considered witchcraft in the 17th century? What were the perceived dangers of witchcraft? How were witches detected? And what were the typical punishments?
Right. Well, first of all, most everyone believed in witches. Witches could cause children to sicken and die. They could cause your animals, your livestock, to become diseased and die. They could bring sickness on a household. Witches could cause storms. They were just general troublemakers, servants of the devil. And it was a capital crime, which came from the Bible, Exodus, "Thou shalt not suffer a witch to live." And as most people know, there were thousands and thousands. Nobody knows, no one will ever know how many witches were put to death, mostly by burning, in Switzerland, Sweden, Germany, Scotland, and most European countries from the Middle Ages, because they were considered heretics also against God, because they served the devil. There were actually some, before the Salem trials, there were at least 16 people executed for witchcraft. So the punishment was it was a capital crime. The punishment was definitely death. It was a time before science, as we know, and Puritans thought everything had a cause. So you blame it on the witches if your animals developed some weird sickness and dropped dead. Things that could not be explained were the cause of witches. How were they detected? Well, and people who studied the Salem trials have heard of spectral evidence, which was used over and over again through the Salem trials, and that was the so-called afflicted girls, although those crazy girls that show up in Arthur Miller's Crucible were not the only afflicted. There were 30-year-old men and young men and middle-aged women who were also so supposedly afflicted. Spectral evidence, which could hang a person accused of witchcraft, was that when someone who was supposedly afflicted and having fits would touch someone accused of witchcraft, and the evil would flow back into the accused, and the afflicted would stop having fits. So until towards the end of the 1692 trials, that was used to hang people. So the Salem trials are really very complicated, which is one reason that I think it has fascinated so many scholars and readers for so long. But there were many causes which all came together in kind of the perfect storm. Religious fanaticism was certainly part of it. It was a breakdown of the government at that time. The old charter had been discontinued, and there were the colonists in New England were awaiting a new charter, so that for six to nine months, there was no legal redress for the colonists because of the change of the kings in England and the formation of the new charter, which took a lot of negotiating between New England and Old England. At that time, 1692, there had been crop failure due to weather, which could be blamed of witches, of course. There were epidemics, smallpox. There had been continual Indian raids and different frontier warfare in Maine and New Hampshire. And the Puritans wondered if God, if we were on serving God and God were on our side, how come we were kept losing the war with the Native Americans? So the leaders of the colony, who had been the clergy and magistrates, lost their power. The religion had lost their power. The new charter that was coming was going to accept all religions, including Quakers, all except Roman Catholics. And most of all, there was this conspiracy theory that all these things were, these bad things were happening because the devil was determined to take over the cities of God that the Puritans and Pilgrims had founded in the American wilderness. And they were hiring witches to human beings to be their helpers. So most people believed in this conspiracy at the time. And when the new governor arrived, which wasn't until May of 1692, which would be 1693, depending, because there was a change of when the year began at that time. When he finally arrived the end of May, the jails were already filled of people who had been accused of witchcraft. The one thing that is not a cause of the Salem witch trials is the, which you probably read about, is the ergot, which is a growth or a poison that grows on rye plants. That's a popular theory for an easy answer that was put out by a graduate student, I don't know, about 20 years ago now, but it was immediately disproved within a few months, disproved by scientists and physicians.
Can you explain that disproved theory a little more?
It's become a popular explanation for the Salem witchcraft because it appeared on Secrets of the Dead program, so people bought into it because it was an easy answer. Well, the theory was that the craziness of the girls, the so-called afflicted teenagers or younger, all were eating from these rye plants. They eating bread made from rye that had on it an ergot, E-R-G-O-T, which is a fungus that grows on rye plants. But anyway, they didn't have the same symptoms, and they weren't eating from the same fields of rye. And also because if you had that sickness, which is kind of like St. Vitus dance from the Middle Ages, if you had that illness, you couldn't turn it off and on in a courtroom, which is what they did. You know, they only had their fits when they were confronted by a accused witch. But we're still studying the trials. And I think they're so popular because so many people were accused in such a short period of time. It was only like a 9-month period, and then it was over. And people had, you know, some people never bought it at that time, didn't buy into it. There were some ministers and businessmen and other leading citizens who never bought into it. But if they didn't support it, then they often got accused themselves, which is what happened to some I wrote about, like John Alden Jr. he was trading with the Indians, which is what made him trading with Native Americans up the coast of Maine, which is what got him into trouble, got him accused.
What were the punishments for being a witch?
Well, hanging. It was a capital crime. So if you were accused and you did go to court and you were put on trial, but you didn't have, you had a jury, but you didn't have any defense lawyers. So even though people could send petitions or they could send documents supporting you as a good citizen, that was kind of overlooked. Not everyone who was accused got hanged, but hanging, it was a capital crime. So if you were accused, and how many people went to the gallows? 19 went to the gallows, men and women, although the majority were women. But children were also accused of witchcraft, although no children were hanged. However, a few women were not hanged because they were pregnant, so they were what they call saved by pleading their belly, because a Puritan court would never hang an unborn child because that unborn baby might be among God's elect, and so they would wait until after the baby was born before they hanged the mother.
Did they force confessions from these women?
Well, they certainly tried to, yes, and they tried to get people, they did get children to accuse their parents, and there are there's a few cases of that. They were definitely coerced and threatened, but the ones who did not confess got hanged. And I think late as the trials went on, people confessed because they noticed that if you confessed, you didn't get hanged, even though they keep you in prison and try to get you to accuse other people, like McCarthyism. But, yeah, they definitely tried to confess because the ministers would urge confessions, too, because, well, they believed they were guilty because they had this belief at the time, as I said, the conspiracy theory, where they thought the devil had his goal to take over New England and defeat Christianity and convert people to the devil's cause.
Prisons from this time period are far different than they are today, of course.
Right.
Could you explain what a 17th century prison in America looked like, how they were operated, and the kinds of criminals that might be found there?
Right. Prisons were seen until the end of the 1700s, or certainly before the Revolution, as places that you would just keep people until their trial. And that's why there were so many witches crowding the prisons when the governor arrived with his new charter, because they couldn't put them on trial until then. Men and women were crowded in together, and children, and the jailer, or turnkey as he was called, would usually live in the prison on the grounds, and his wife would cook for the prisoners as well as for her own family. And there's a good example of that at the old jail in York, Maine, where the jailer's quarters are attached right to this early 18th century prison. The prisons began to change when the clerical power, the ministers lost their power, when all religious sects except Roman Catholics were accepted in New England. The use of scripture as a legal guide had become outdated. And also there was the influence from England of the Enlightenment, John Locke, and such Englishmen who saw mankind not as born evil, born bad, as the Puritans had seen mankind, or John Calvin had, but as born good. And these European reformers believed that offenders, criminals, could be reformed and live a good life. Part of this was the Quaker influence in Pennsylvania, who also believed and taught from their religion that individual could be morally improved. The prisons began to be seen as workhouses. Labor could be productive and could teach a prisoner to have a trade, to make a living, to function in society. And men and women were separated from this time. Felons were separated from people who had committed misdemeanors. There was a leading light in Pennsylvania named Dr. Benjamin Rush. He founded the Pennsylvania Prison Society, which changed prisons, including even the architecture of prisons, where they were not just holding places, but became places where prisoner could have time to consider their crime and have their conscience reformed and be reestablished and taught to reenter society.
You're saying that sentences during that time didn't include jail time.
Right. They were mostly holding places, right. They weren't assigned to a certain number of years in prison. They were holding places until they could put you on trial. And sometimes it was a long time before your trial because a lot of times because villages and towns were spread out, they had like circuit judges who would trial, and actually John Adams, our second president, was one, a lawyer who was a circuit lawyer, went from town to town to put people on trial. And then the idea of punishment as humiliation hadn't worked, so they kind of got out of putting the prisoner on, you know, in the stocks and the pillories. It hadn't prevented mayhem and madness.
Can you tell us about debtor's prison? How did debtor's prison work?
Right. Debtor's prison was much, much nicer. You got a furnished place. You also got freedom of the yard to walk around. You could have your family come in and visit you, partly because most of the people in debtor's prison came from the upper classes. And also, and even as a debtor and also as some other prisoner, you could earn money while in prison. In other words, if you were a shoemaker or depending on what you did, you could earn money and help pay your debt. If you were a debtor, your land was usually seized to help pay your debts. Also, all prisoners had to pay their prison fees. So whether you were accused of witchcraft and exonerated at the end, you still couldn't get out of prison till you paid your fee. And that meant, and the same for debtors, that meant you had to pay part of the turnkey's salary. You were charged room and board in a prison, and that meant not only for your food, but also for your blankets, and not in the case of debtors, but if you were a witch and put into chains and manacles, you had to pay for the rental of those chains and manacles. And there's a sad case of a poor woman from Cambridge, Lydia Dustin, 67 years old, who was accused of witchcraft, and then she was exonerated, and she would have been released, but she couldn't pay her prison fees. So she died in prison for the want of 6 shillings.
Tell us the story of Patience Sampson Boston, the penitent prisoner.
Right, right. And if you or your audience were to visit museums of Old York in Maine, you could see someone playing the role of Patience Boston. She was a sad case of, she was born in 1735, and she's actually born a Native American princess on Cape Cod. But her parents were in poverty, and so she was put into a white family as a servant or a slave, and she was very rebellious. She did a lot of night walking. She liked to frequent the taverns and drink alcohol. She was a fornicator, and ran away from her home. She was married eventually to an African-American whaler, but by the time she was 23, she had been sold into Maine as a slave because she was so rebellious and such a handful. Then she was in, New England liked to call their slave servants, but they did have slaves. She was accused of murdering the 8-year-old grandson of her master in Casco Bay, which is now Portland, Maine. She was supposedly pushed him into a well, but there were no witnesses, so there was never proof. But she did finally confess. She was pregnant when she was in prison, so they waited to hang her until after her baby was born. So she was actually incarcerated for a year, which was unusual, before she was hanged. And during that time, the ministers in the area paraded to her prison cell to try to convert her to Christianity and to try so that she would have salvation and to get her to confess to her crime, which she probably never committed, but she did confess because she would rather prefer to go to heaven than to hell. So the ministers, who were well known in Maine as Cotton Mather and his father were in Massachusetts, Samuel and Joseph Moody, paraded to her cell, and then when she went to be hanged in July of 1735, they accompanied her to the gallows at York Harbor and then published their sermons afterwards as lessons for the living. And those published sermons are actually, that case can be accessed online. Patience Boston. Boston was her married name. Patience Sampson was her Native American name, as a child. Anyway, you can read the whole sermon by Samuel Moody online. It's a detailed biography of her life.
So where can people get your book and find out more about you?
Oh, okay. It's available on, I guess, many bookstores. It's available, and especially historic sites. I've seen it at Sturbridge Village and Plymouth Plantation. I don't know about the Midwest or Far West. But it's available on Amazon and Barnes & Noble. It's published by Globe Pequot Press, Connecticut Tribe, and they have been bought out by Roman and Littlefield, Roman and Littlefield. It was published in paperback in 2012, so you can just Google it. And I also have two e-books on Amazon. One is about a witch. One is called Abigail Accused, story of a Salem witch hunt, which is about one of the accused convicted witches who escaped because she could plead her belly. And another is a book about pirates, Captain Redleg's Graves, pirate by accident, who happened to be an ancestor of my husband. But he was a Caribbean pirate.
Thanks again for your time.
Yeah, well, thank you.
Thanks again to Juliet Mofford, the name of her book again, The Devil Made Me Do It, Crime and Punishment in Early New England. This has been another episode of The Most Notorious Podcast, broadcasting to every dark and cobwebbed corner of the world. I'm Eric Rivenis, and have a safe tomorrow.
Hello, my name is Matt, host of the Pirate History Podcast. Pirates rank among the most mythologized and romanticized of all historical figures. It can become easy to forget that pirates were real people that had real-world concerns. If you like tales of high seas adventure, derring do, and also want to learn more about who Blackbeard supported to be king, you can learn more about all of that at the Pirate History Podcast.